Blog Talk Radio.
Largely unchanged.
Michelle Bachmann comes in fourth with 11, down from 13% last week. Rick Perry stayed stagnant at 9 and apparently unaffected by his controversial gay marriage war on Christmas ad last week. And Rick Santorum came in with 8%, while John Huntsman rounded out the field with 5%. It's pretty good.
Interesting, huh?
Yeah, so Ron Paul is taking over the game. That's really, that was good news, I thought. This is freaky here. Confirmed Fukushima disaster contaminated ocean with 50 million times normal radiation leaks.
And it's still leaking.
Mm-hmm. And leaks still. excuse me one second. Pull that up. This is from naturalnews.com.
Okay. There are suddenly... things are suddenly heating up again with Fukushima. As we reported yesterday, the southern wall of Fukushima Reactor No. 4 apparently collapsed over the past few days, calling into question the structural integrity of the remainder of the containment building. The mainstream media has said absolutely nothing about this development, continuing its pattern of downplaying news involving Fukushima radiation or the flawed structure of nuclear power plants. This is hardly surprising, given many of the largest media outlets, such as NBC and MSNBC, are owned by corporations such as General Electric, the designer of many of the world's nuclear power plants. Photos of the failed structure have emerged on enewnews.com, where a report explains that a once intact wall is now essentially missing, and that further degradation of the structure could lead to mass evacuations in Japan. As the report is still not confirmed by other sources, we continue to take this with a sense of caution here at Natural News. We also continue to monitor the situation and report any relevant developments. What has hit the mainstream media, however, is a report entitled Impact of the Fukushima Nuclear Power Plants on Marine Radioactivity, authored by Ken Buesler and Michio Oyama and Masio Fukusawa. The report, published in Environmental Science and Technology, reveals that the levels of radioactive cesium reach 50 times normal... 50 million times normal levels. In the ocean water off the coast of Fukushima Daiichi facility. Even more concerning, the abstract of this paper concludes, the concentrations through the end of July remain higher than expected, implying continued releases from the reactors or other contaminated sources, such as groundwater or coastal sediments. This, of course, contradicts mainstream media reports, which for the most part stated that the radiation was contained and was not leaking directly into the environment. Only the alternative press has covered the real story on Fukushima, which now has become the worst radiological accident in the history of human civilization. This same study ultimately concludes that this level of radiation contamination of the ocean is essentially harmless, stating, dose calculations suggest minimal impact on the marine biota or humans due to direct exposure in surrounding ocean waters. So considerations for biological uptake and consumption of seafood is discussed and further study is warranted. That's a conclusion to review the skepticism and caution, of course, as it says on one hand that it's no problem, yet on the other hand, maybe you shouldn't eat the seafood because we really don't know what quantity and concentration of radioactive elements may be ingested and concentrated by seafood sources. Radioactive strontium admittedly leaked into the ocean. Another important development now surfacing is that TEMCO has finally admitted that alarming quantities of radioactive strontium, which has roughly a 30-year half-life, have leaked into the ocean and that the leaks are ongoing. According to TEMCO, which repeatedly and deliberately lied to the public in order to downplay any bad news about radiological leaks, 26 billion becquerels of radioactive materials have leaked into the ocean due to the Fukushima accident. Okay.
It suggests that the releases have not ended, so that of concern.
So that is of concern.
It is. The contaminants end up in the marine sediments, mud, then they will remain there for decades to come, and thus potentially be of concern for benthic biota and consumers of benthic fish, shellfish. I don't know what benthic means, but
I don't either.
Any local filter feeders near the water source at the coast.
The worst may yet to come. What's clear from all this is that the Fukushima facility remains highly unstable and could dramatically worsen, especially if another earthquake or tsunami strikes the area and causes further degradation of the structural integrity of containment buildings, which still house nuclear fuel rods. Also, the Fukushima catastrophe is without question the most massive radiological disaster ever recorded in human history. The mainstream media has consistently or intentionally downplayed the severity of the Fukushima disaster, perhaps to try to calm fears by denying the true extent of the problem. Temco routinely and habitually lied about the status of Fukushima during the meltdown and in the days and weeks that followed the meltdown. We therefore cannot rely upon official sources to accurately inform us of the actual status of the Fukushima facility. The risk of being misled by those official sources is very high.
If you want the truth, don't trust official sources. Under such circumstances, the wise thing to do is stay informed and get prepared in case the Fukushima situation suddenly worsens. Hopefully, everyone in North America knows by now that another release of radiation from Fukushima could widely contaminate the west coast of the United States with radioactive fallout. And given that government agencies in both the United States and Japan have altered the definitions of allowable radiation exposure, it hardly seems reasonable to think that these governments are erring on the side of caution. In fact, by all accounts, these governments are proactively working to downplay the severity of any future radiological event by claiming that the levels of contamination previously considered poisoning are now suddenly within safe limits. But within those definitions of safe, but within those definitions of safe limits, after all, the U.S. government also thinks it's perfectly safe for you to drink fluoride, microwave your body at TSA checkpoints, eat genetically modified organisms, get yourself repeatedly injected with chemical adjuvants and vaccines, and drink aspartame. Ah, come on. What's a little radiation on top of that?
Huh.
Interesting, though. There was another one. I think I got it. One about aspartame. Interesting one here. I don't know if we got enough.
Speaking of interesting ones that you can't find, I tried to go to the video on pilot who talked about chem spraying.
Yeah.
And when I went to that,
you needed, huh?
No, it was. It said it was taken down by YouTube.
Yeah.
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 So that was a disappointment.
But that happens. That happens when the government tells YouTube to take something down. Cannabis legal and regulated in Spain for 2012.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cannabis news by Canazine. Following news that Switzerland will permit its residents to grow 4 cannabis plants for personal consumption for January 1, 2012. The vast parliament in Spain has followed suit. A new bill will officially regulate the cultivation, sale, and consumption of cannabis. That's in Spain in 2012, so they're forethought. They're a forethinking country. Joe Salente, Goldman Sachs behind the MF Global scandal. I thought this was kind of interesting. Let's see if I can grab this here. If you're curious about the MF Global scandal, wouldn't surprise you that Goldman Sachs took all the dough.
No, that's never a surprise,
yeah.
Is it?
All right. So it says
it's kind of an odd blog here.
Yeah. Goldman Sachs behind MF Global scandal. MF Global is in constant with the political class.
It's a trance with the political class. Likely, no one will get in trouble, and the taxpayers will have to pay for Obama buddies. Why don't the FBI arrest John Corzine? I mean, the FBI spends a lot of time on the Italian mafia. Why not these bankers? The Italian mafia seem like to compared to these criminals. All the crooks are from J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, etc. These in our government and are robbing the country blind. You think people would stand up, but then again, people are like sheep. They just lay down and die. Do we live in a third world country or what?
Let's go on.
There's a little audio piece here. Let's see what this has to say.
Welcome back. Today there were rumors circulating that the Strait of Hormuz was closed for military drills. They were rumors that turned out not to be true, but this is the stuff oil traders buy and sell on. And reportedly, you see that spike there. Oil went up to more than $100 a barrel as a result, reportedly, when we saw Brent crude jump to $111 a barrel. More importantly, though, these rumors were because of a report from a high-ranking Iranian official that Iran's military will practice sealing off its Strait of Hormuz, a move showing Iran's capability to disrupt the world's oil supply and make life lousy for customers around the world, oil consumers around the world. Now, this Strait of Hormuz is otherwise known as the world's most important oil transport. Back to MS Global, ask you one more question, because you kept...
There we go.
Gerald Celente, founder of Trends Research Institute. I want to bring him back into the conversation because I want to talk to him about this and as well as some other stories going on. Gerald, I want to bring you back in. Before we move on to this, I want to just, back to MS Global, ask you one more question because you kept saying there's something else going on here, there's something else going on here, and I really wanted to get at the root of what you really think that is. And one thing that came up for us is, are you suggesting anything having to do with gold, that you don't think maybe there's enough physical gold to meet the paper obligations or claims?
Exactly. I don't think the COMEX has it. And I've been hearing stories coming out that what they are delivering isn't of the finest that it's supposed to be. And I also don't believe the Chicago Mercantile Exchange has the money to back what they said they were going to do. Again, you know, we sent the video out of Terrence Duffy over a year ago, the CEO of the CME, saying that they have $100 billion in collateral. So, you know, so when deals go bad like the MF Global did, customers wouldn't lose their money. They can't come up with what? $500 million they've come up with? I mean, we're talking $1.2 billion, and you're claiming that you have $100 billion in collateral to cover this? So, no, something's wrong here. There's a lot more going on than meets the eye. And also, let's put this in perspective, Lauren. We're talking about the eighth largest bankruptcy in American history.
That's
this
right.
is huge.
Yeah.
And the implications are far-reaching. So what they're doing is they're trying to narrow it down into like a one-off. And I'm saying there's a lot more going on with other institutions as well that are ready to come down. Because remember, it was only until September that Moody's downgraded the rating of MF Global.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a lot more trouble out there that they're not showing.
Do you, just to follow up one more question on that, do you think this is a canary in the coal mine as far as insolvent firms or firms that have made bad bets and are getting away with it or dipping into customer accounts or something having to do with physical gold and the not having enough available?
Combination of all three. I don't care which institution it is. They're over-leveraged. They're over-gambled. They have a lot of rotten assets on their books, and that's what the whole nation is about, whether it's in the United States or over in Europe,
mm-hmm.
holding a lot of bad paper and having made a lot of their Celentes to pay the Goldman Sachs gang, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I want to thank you for sharing those thoughts with us. I want to switch gears, though. I do want to bring this Strait of Hormuz story because we saw oil increase kind of on this rumor, but there was a report from an Iraqi.
All right. That's enough of that. Basically, said that MF was stealing the, you know, it was bullshit.
I thought he lost a lot of money.
He did. He lost. He tried to get his gold, and they didn't have any. This is disturbing. 25% of Marines would shoot Americans. 100% of the Oath Keepers would shoot them back. Right? I like that idea. There is an Oath Keeper group, and I think it's important. This is a short.
Is this real life?
Yeah, this is real life.
Had no opinion? Firing on their own fellow Americans? Of the remaining 26.34% answered that they would fire on their fellow Americans, U.S. citizens, who refused or resisted the confiscation of firearms banned by the U.S. government, who had no authority constitutionally to enact such a ban.
My name is Sergeant Charles Dyer. I'm an Oath Keeper. I'm the 1st Light Armored Reconnaissance Battalion out of Camp Pendleton, California. I absolutely could not, I can't imagine that we're living in the times where I have to worry about having to confiscate the weapons from the American people. Is that freedom? It's absolutely not freedom. That I have to worry that we're going to quarantine a city for the purposes of keeping them in there hostage, like Katrina? Absolutely not. That's not freedom in any way that you can think of it. I'm almost speechless whenever I try to talk about this because I can't imagine that we're living in this kind of time. It really bothers me. Absolutely.
Because of the quotation, March 11th, 1993, by President Clinton, because of the Clinton assault weapons ban that was being enacted, I formed a scenario that I knew would be explosive, shouldn't have been, but because of the times and the machinations of certain forces to disarm the American people.
I don't care whether it's your governor or your senator or your representative or your president. I'm sure you can look at instances. Days within having sworn his oath, the person violates it blatantly. That's a dangerous thing.
I, George Walker Bush, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
None of this stuff would be happening if it was stuck with the Constitution and stuck within its parameters.
And we learned the American dream, and we were out there doing that American dream and working, and we were electing representatives that we felt were going to represent us while we were doing other things and maintaining our families and raising our families and doing the right thing as we thought. And I think we were duped in some cases where they've actually let us down.
Combatant status itself is an extension of that. When I was writing at Yale, I wrote a paper on any combatant status. It won their award for best people in the Bill of Rights. And unfortunately, when Obama was elected, he didn't repeal any of those things. And he...
I'm going to let that go because these are oath takers, Marines, so on, that have provided to fight their own countrymen, their own military, okay, rather than shoot American people or confiscate American people's guns and stuff, you know, against the I have a degree fully with them on that. All right. Some crazy things going on, I'll tell you. There's one here. The reason that the House Democrats refused to sign this bill tonight, which was unemployment extension and so on and so forth,
mm-hmm.
was because the Republicans were playing bullshit with it.
Now let's listen to this. The payroll tax cut package engineered by House Speaker John Boehner was overwhelmingly approved by Republicans despite a veto threat from President Obama, escalating a year-end showdown over extending the benefits for 160 million American workers. Passage of the measure Tuesday was a momentary victory for the Speaker, who struggled to get reluctant Republicans on board for the tax break, which puts $1,000 in average workers' pockets. It was approved 234 to 193 with 224 Republicans and 10 Democrats. But the Republican win is expected to be short-lived, as the bill has limited chances in the Senate, where Democrats oppose the GO priorities that Boehner added to the bill to win Republican votes, including one to accelerate the controversial Keystone XL pipeline. The tax break expires on December 31st, and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid warned Boehner in a phone call that GOP leaders have spent too much time catering to their conservative flank rather than negotiating with Democrats on a compromise. This is what I told him. We are not going to finish the work of our country this year unless we work together, Reid said. They're wasting time catering to the Tea Party when they should be working with Democrats on a bipartisan package that can pass both houses. To bring Republicans to the table, Democrats have slow-walked an unrelated year-end spending bill that is needed to keep the government running, preventing the GOP-led House from finishing its work and leaving town for the holidays. Such a strategy is risky, as Congress must approve the funding bill or the federal government will shut down on Friday. But the leverage proved irresistible. Obama, in strategizing with Reid over the weekend, insisted that the bills be linked. Obama said that nothing gets done until everything gets done, according to a senior administration official. Republicans were caught off guard by the move and thought that they had a handshake agreement with Democrats on the spending bill. But Democrats said unresolved issues remain, including provisions on abortion, travel to Cuba, funding levels for the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which plays a role in Wall Street regulation. Here we are with government shutdown pending Friday, a deal already made, and I think it's appropriate to ask the president and the majority leader why they want to undo a deal that was already made, said Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the Republican leader, and threatens to shut down the government here the week before Christmas. The House vote on the payroll tax package underscored the work Boehner has done to bring unity to an often divided GOP. At a closed-door meeting before the vote, only one Republican rose to publicly question the policy, those familiar with the session said. Conservative Republican Representative Jasper Chaffetz of Utah delivered a message to his peers that noted the hard scrabble politics before them. I stood up and said, I'm really good at voting no. I spent 2 years mastering that. This has a lot of positive in it, Chaffetz said. And he said he would go on to vote for the package. The payroll, which has been placed for 2011, reduces Social Security contributions for workers.
Lost contributions to the Social Security Trust Fund would be replenished. Under the GOP proposal, they would be backfilled by spending cuts elsewhere in the budget. And the chief actuary for the retirement system has said that the fund would be unaffected. Anyway, to make a long story short, the GOP, you know, played bullshit with this thing.
And, so it's not going to
so
pass.
So it probably won't pass. All right, the Senate. Let's go on from here. Okay. There's just one more thing. We're going to bring up our guest, Nick Bryant, in just a minute.
The author of the Franklin Scandal.
Right. And we'll have him explain that. And, of course, it's one on pedophile, a national pedophile ring. Here's kind of another thing that are quite...
from News Junkie Post.
U.S. homeless. 1.6 million children are homeless, up by 38% since 2007.
That's really sad.
According to a report released today by the National Center on Homelessness, more than 1.6 million children are currently homeless in America. This amounts to one child in 45. It represents a dramatic increase of 38% since the onset of the recession in 2007. The report, America's Youngest Outcast, paints a grim picture, and it provides a a ranking between the 50 states. It also recommends some policy solutions to be implemented. All right.
Who knows where the battle happened? This article also has some pictures with it. Pretty sad.
The report shows that the homeless children in the United States suffer from hunger, poor physical condition, emotional health, as well as limited academic proficiency in reading and math. The constant barrage of stressful and traumatic experiences has a profound effect on their development and ability to learn. According to the report, 30,000 children become homeless each week and more than 4,400 each day. And yet the planning and social safety net to protect these vulnerable children is extremely limited. 16 states have no planning at all, and only 7 states are actively addressing the issue. States faring the best are Vermont, Minnesota, Nebraska, South Dakota, North Dakota, Maine, New Hampshire, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Montana, and Iowa. Very bottom is Georgia, Florida, Nevada, Louisiana, New Mexico, Arizona, Mississippi, and at the very bottom, Alabama. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah, man, oh man.
I noticed Connecticut isn't at the top, and we're not at the bottom.
Somewhere. In the face of this man-made disaster, there must be no further cuts in federal and state programs to help homeless children and families. Deeper cuts could only create more homelessness. It will cost us more to fix in the long run. We can take specific action now in areas of housing, child care, education, domestic violence, and so on and so forth, and child homelessness. It's a terrible thing.
And now we're coming into the winter. It can only get worse.
It's only going to get worse.
It's really sad.
It's
because there were big cuts in the fuel oil assistance program.
Yep. And so
I don't know where the money's going to come to cover that.
Okay. It is now time to go to our guest.
Okay, and, Leo, why don't you call
our
guest? And I'll talk a little bit about him.
That's Nick Bryant.
He's the author of the Franklin scandal, and that scandal occurred during Bush number one administration. And you really didn't hear too much about it. It was written, it was exposed, I think, in the Washington Post.
Times.
Washington Times down in D.C. Kind of died a natural death.
Well, Nick picked it up. An incredible book on it.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Nick. How are you? This is Leo.
And this
is
Lila. Hi, Lila, my co-host. We were just talking about your book. Maybe you might want to give
our listeners
a little bit more on your research regarding this as to where it's going from here.
Okay, and it's the interview is going to be about a half an hour.
Yeah.
Yes.
You got 30 minutes.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about your book, and I'm sure when our listeners hear you talk, they'll remember a little bit of what happened during that scandal. So if you just refresh their memory a little bit.
Okay, and the interview starting now?
Yeah, go ahead.
You're on.
The Franklin scandal is a book that I researched for about 7 years, and it took me 7 years to research it. And while I was researching the Franklin scandal, I ended up traveling about 40,000 miles around the United States of America. The Franklin scandal is about a interstate pedophile network that flew children from coast to coast and pandered them to the rich and powerful. The ring's pimps were a pair of political power brokers, one was Lawrence E. King of Omaha, Nebraska, and the other was Craig Spence of Washington, D.C., and this ring plundered Boys Town, the distinguished orphanage on the outskirts of Omaha, for a lot of its underage victims. They also got victims from the foster care system, and then they got kids that kind of fell through the cracks that were runaways or had become disenfranchised from their family. And they would fly these kids from coast to coast, and I managed to acquire the sealed grand jury documentation of one of the grand juries that covered it up in Nebraska. There were two grand juries that covered this up in Nebraska. One was a state grand jury and one was a federal grand jury. And it gave me the names of like 60 victims that I eventually tracked down a number of them and got a number of them to talk to me. And it also gave me flight receipts, police reports, social service reports. And I was really able to put all this together and make an incontrovertible case that this pedophile network existed, that this pedophile network pandered to the rich and powerful, and that this pedophile network was covered up by state and federal authorities.
Now, it seems like it's a very timely book because right now we're listening to the mainstream media and we hear a lot about Jerry Sandusky and
Penn State,
and
also up in Syracuse, another coach was just indicted, and I guess there's even more that is breaking.
Actually, there's Brooklyn's Poly Prep County Day School. There's the Bat Boys at Fenway Park, and now the AAU president has allegations that he was molesting adolescents too. So it's starting to break somewhat on a number of people of secular society who mm-hmm. were once considered pillars of the community.
But this charity,
Second Mile,
all right, how deep does this run? As far as who are their donors and what are their, who are the, are any of them some of the same group that were involved with the Franklin scandal?
Do you think?
Have you seen any connections at all to some of these people?
No. There was a very high-ranking person in the Bush administration who had a high-ranking job in Pennsylvania throughout the 1980s, but I haven't been able to connect Second Mile Foundation to him at all. I've looked at connections. What I have seen with Second Mile is that Penn State and a number of its affiliates have contributed thousands and thousands of dollars to Second Mile Foundation. And Penn State certainly knew about the allegations in 1998, and then they knew about them again in 2002. So I find it very bizarre that Penn State is giving thousands and thousands of dollars to someone who they believe or is alleged has an organization and is an alleged pedophile. I find that very bizarre indeed.
And very risky, because it seems to me if any of these cases wind their way through court, there'll be huge lawsuits against Penn State.
Well,
it's very troubling with Penn State because you would think, common decency would dictate, or actually maybe even demand at this point, that Penn State be transparent, because there have been allegations in 1998 and then in 2002, and certainly Joe Paterno and a number of people knew about Jerry Sandusky, certainly by 2002. And what I find really troubling is that ESPN petitioned Penn State to get its records from its 1998 investigation. And Penn State took that case to the Pennsylvania's Office of Open Records. And the Office of Open Records ruled that Penn State didn't have to cough up the 1998 documents. So we have Penn State, in broad daylight, basically, essentially covering up the relationship with Jerry Sandusky and what they knew in 1998. And, they're doing this in broad daylight, which I just find mind-boggling because, as I said, common decency would demand a certain amount of transparency at this point.
What would be the reason? What was the reason the judge gave for not allowing it?
It was ruled that these records were Penn State's to release or not to release, and that was it. It wasn't actually a judge. It was the Office of Open Records in Pennsylvania.
Because the first judge that gave him a $100,000 bond, okay, turned out to be a contributor or a sponsor of Second Mile, okay, and a former friend of Sandusky, and never recused herself.
That's a major problem. When these kind of scandals or allegations occur, the abuser often has powerful allies within law enforcement, government, and the media. and they decide that the details are just too sordid, they're too hot to handle. And then you add to that mix the public's understandable squeamishness towards the entire subject of pedophilia.
Hello?
Are you with us now?
Yes.
Okay. I thought we lost you there for a minute.
But
so you think there's little will sometimes to continue on with something like this. People with their natural squeamishness, as you said, tend to maybe deny or overlook these things.
I'm sorry, you can answer that.
Well, there's a tremendous amount of naivete in our society about child abuse. People don't want to think that it exists, and people certainly don't want to think that it gets covered up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why my book, The Franklin Scandal, is so important, because if someone is really going to understand child trafficking in the United States of America, my book is the template of how to understand that. My book basically explicates how a nationwide pedophile network worked. My book explicates how it got the kids, where it got the kids from, like, Boys Town, foster care, kids that had fallen through the cracks. And my book also explicates how both the government, working in conjunction with the media, covered it up. And I think that although there were some very corrupt people that covered up the Franklin scandal, there were a number of people, good citizens, good Americans, who just didn't want to believe that such a thing could exist, and they certainly didn't want to believe that law enforcement would be covering up something like this, something as horrific as child abuse.
Well, you can see just from what you're saying some similarities to this recent case. They use a charity organization, the Second Mile, which supposedly was founded to help disadvantaged kids, and so they preyed on the helpless and kids that were poor.
Yeah, I mean, disadvantaged kids are the best kids to prey upon, and not only because their familial connections are somewhat tenuous, people looking after them, but they're really looking for love. And not only are they looking for love, but in the Franklin scandal, I found that it doesn't take that much money. And in other pedophile networks that I've investigated, it doesn't take that much money to get disadvantaged kids to sell their bodies as young men or young women or as young adolescents. It doesn't take a lot of money. So these are the perfect kids to prey upon. And also, when they come forward, if they come forward, you've got a kid that's from a disadvantaged background. You can poke holes in that. You've got a kid that's probably abused drugs. You can poke holes in that. So these are the perfect kids to prey upon if you're a predator.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, not to disregard the conspiracy about an organization, but you know even. So many of these, there are so many individuals, a number of them here in our state in Connecticut recently that have been busted for child pornography. But the pornography that they're getting, you know, a lot, it's all through an internet source, and obviously provided by some, you know, websites, you know, or something, you know, in order to get it. What are the when the Franklin scandal broke? I mean, there weren't any websites. I mean, there wasn't an internet at that time to speak of. But you know, today, Nick, how do you you know, everything is so much more exploitable, and there's so many more millions of children and young people. That are selling themselves or either
being exploited,
to sell themselves. How do you see that there doesn't seem to be any control over this? You know, what is your opinion of that, and how do you think that this can be stopped or at least stunted?
Well, there's some very solid anti-trafficking laws in the books. Now they have to be enforced. And if you look at the Franklin scandal and other pedophile scandals, the Department of Justice has covered them up, and the FBI was certainly complicit in covering up the pedophile network out of Nebraska that I wrote about. And I know of another large pedophile network where the Department of Justice was instrumental in covering that up. So what we need, what Americans need, is an awareness of this disease, because you cannot cure a disease unless it's been diagnosed. And people have to, there has to be a diagnosis provided that child abuse just might possibly be rampant, and child abuse and its cover-up just might possibly be rampant in the United States. And once enough Americans realize that, once that has filtered into your average American and then into social services, law enforcement, so people will look for this type of thing. People will look for these type of cover-ups. Law enforcement will look for these type of networks. Only when that happens, when there's a much broader understanding of it, and what I mean there, when there's a broader understanding and the disease has been diagnosed, only then will you be able, as a society, to cure it.
Well, I was the chief of police here in one of the towns in Connecticut that was just recently busted for child pornography, right? And his trial is up for is coming up soon, but with somebody like a chief of police doing this, I mean, there's got to be connections in order for this to be happening. There's got to be these kind of connections all over the country, soliciting and promoting, pimping these children and these photographs and so on and so forth.
And they have vast resources. I mean, with organizations like the Second Mile and Foster Care, and in your case, the same type of organizations out in Nebraska,
Boys Town.
And it's just a very, very sad thing. But we certainly hope that by getting plenty of publicity moving forward to this Jerry Sandusky issue, that something will be done about it. Do you have any hope that because it's in the mainstream media and they're talking a lot about it, that this case will go somewhere, that there won't be so much?
People in the mainstream media have finally sought me out to interview me about the Franklin scandal and my knowledge of child abuse and trafficking. And I have given this book to everybody. Everybody in the mainstream media has had my book. The New York Times Book Review has had my book. The New York Review of Books has had my book. Everybody's had my book, and no one's been willing to touch it. And now people are starting to come out of the woodwork and talk to me and interview me. And the only thing that I can say about that is it's just really sad that people are seeking me out for interviews because additional children have been hurt and possibly destroyed. I mean, that kind of breaks my heart. But at least the issue is getting noticed at this point.
Good, good. So what in particular do they want from you? Are they looking for a pattern? Are they looking to do some investigation on their own, to talk to people, or are they just simply talking to you about what you know?
People in the mainstream media are interviewing me, and one very large mainstream publication asked me to write an article, a publication that reaches millions of people every month. I wrote the article, I gave it to them, and I'm cautiously optimistic. I talked about the three pedophile networks that I know of in the article, and we'll see what happens. And I talked to it, and I showed how these pedophile networks, or at least two of them, had some eerie similarities to Jerry Sandusky and Second Mile.
Really?
So you see
a pattern there.
Are these still operating? Any of these three? Because I know in your book you mentioned a number of them, but are those still in operation?
One might be still in operation. It might still be in operation in the United States, and if it's not in operation in the United States, I'm sure it's operating offshore.
Because I mean, involving people like George Bush Sr. And once you do that, you're involved with the entire government. And now, of course, the Carlyle Group, which is you got to wonder how far this goes, and how far up this goes, and how deep it is, and who's involved. I mean, do you have you found any links to any of these people, or any of these officials or government leaders or known tycoons or known industrialists or anybody that we would know,
the Franklin's The Franklin scandal. Are you still with me?
Yeah, we're right here.
The Franklin scandal goes all the way up the food chain as far as politics, and I've been investigating someone named Jeffrey Epstein in Miami, Florida, who lives in Palm Beach, Florida, who has also exploited a number of minors, and his exploitation had been covered up by the Department of Justice. And he was a financial person. So I think Americans are shocked right now about the coaches and these sports personalities. But once the levy starts breaking with politicians and people in finance, then it'll truly be staggering.
It struck me as funny. Back in 4 or 5 years ago, when all the scandals broke in Washington there about the certain pedophiles, I think one was Foley and a number of others, but it came and it left. You know, the people wound up resigning. Nobody that I know of got indicted. They just resigned, and that was the end of it.
Hmm.
Have you heard of any of these politicians ever? Having any further anything else happening to them?
No, in the Franklin scandal, I proved that a lot of the kids were flown to Washington, D.C. I mean, when I acquired a lot of the sealed exhibits of one of the grand juries, I acquired the flight receipts of the pedophile network, or a number of the flight, like 200 of them, and the vast majority of them went to Washington, D.C. And in the Franklin scandal, I proved that there was a house in Washington, D.C. where a lot of these pedophilic parties or orgies went down that was wired for audiovisual blackmail. So a number of our politicians, I believe, and I make a pretty strong case for it in the Franklin scandal, are compromised, sexually compromised. If they're not compromised with children, then they're compromised with young men or young women. I mean, they're compromised. And it creates, the mafia had a word for it, omerta, a code of silence. I mean, people that are compromised definitely have a code of silence, and that's what we have right now, and that's the wall that we have to puncture to break through is this omerta.
It really seems to make a lot of sense when you see how Congress is acting toward so much and who they're kowtowing to, who actually has the – how they can be so indifferent to the needs and the suffering of the American people, as opposed to the, desires of the 1% or the desires of a few elite people that are funding their campaigns, basically. But
well, when they're being held hostage for their actions.
But they're also being held
hostage,
it appears, yeah.
But you wonder in this current, you can understand if children are being flown to Washington and politicians are being videotaped, it makes you speculate what is at the basis of this new sex scandal and how far-reaching this one is. I think my guess is that it goes a whole lot deeper and higher than Jerry Sandusky.
Well, we just don't know yet, and here's the troubling thing with this scandal to me. Penn State knew about Jerry Sandusky in 1998, and they knew about him in 2002. And actually, it's on record that the director of Second Mile was informed about Jerry Sandusky in 2002. Now, you could make an argument that, okay, the official story is that Bill Paterno didn't know about Jerry Sandusky till 2002. But yet, Jerry Sandusky retired. Jerry Sandusky, the first allegations of molestation came up in 1998. He retired in 1999 at the age of 57 at the peak of his coaching career. And then Penn State gave him $143,000 that we know about as a severance package and then $58,000 a year. But here's what's troubling, is Penn State and a number of its affiliates have continued to pour tens of thousands of dollars into Second Mile Foundation. Thousands and thousands of dollars. Now, if Joe Paterno said, okay, we're going to cover up this Jerry Sandusky thing because we don't want to blight the Penn State or Penn State football. I'm not really morally dope that way, but I can kind of see why someone would do that. They don't want their whole program or their legacy to be blighted by Jerry Sandusky. I'm not morally dope that way, but I can kind of see it. But, I mean, if Joe Paterno had any decency at that point, he would have said, okay, we're going to cover this up, but we're not going to give Jerry Sandusky or his foundation another penny. If there was some morality involved, you could see that happening instead of we're going to give Jerry Sandusky a cover-up, we're going to give him a nice severance package, a nice parachute, and then we're going to pump thousands and thousands of dollars into his foundation. That's really problematic to me.
You wonder why they were keeping that whole thing alive when they knew all about it.
But the thing that was more troubling was, is even after these indictments were made, all this stuff with Sandusky was made, he had to take the kids. He was told not to have the kids on campus anymore. They didn't want any of these kids on campus any longer. And then what happened is, turns out that Second Mile wound up paying hundreds of thousands of dollars to Penn State in order to allow them to bring the kids back on campus. That was under Sandusky. That was amazing when I heard that.
I'm not familiar with that. I will definitely look into it. But, the whole interaction between Penn State and Second Mile and the money, I mean, it's very troubling. And this is the question. I mean, was Penn State doing this to save face? Or does Jerry Sandusky have some type of leverage on Penn State?
Right.
I mean, it's an A, B, or all the above type question at this point.
You know what? The first thing that came to my mind, of course, was the alumni. You know, and who are some of the alumni of Penn State? Who are some of the famous alumni, or who would be backing this program, who might be involved with something like this with Sandusky?
Makes you wonder. You don't know. It's just speculate on those kinds of things.
Yeah, you know, like who knew that George H. Senior there would have been playing with little boys, you know? It staggers the imagination, really.
But
think how far it goes.
But I'm really pleased to hear that the mainstream media is paying some attention to your book, The Franklin Scandal. Because it's an excellent book,
very
well written, and a real eye-opener. And maybe it'll be like the basis to help people explore what's happening with this Second Mile or what has happened, and maybe we'll be able to go forward and do something about it. I do hope so. I mean, that is my hope, and I'm sure it's yours too.
It's my hope, too. As I said earlier in the show, people really can't understand child trafficking in the United States and the various facets of it and how malignant it actually is until they read the Franklin scandal. The Franklin scandal, most people, of course, everyone looks upon child trafficking as a bad thing, but they all look at it from 25,000 feet. The Franklin scandal brings the reader face-to-face with child trafficking. And some people find that very horrific, and I understand that because I lived in it, that world for 7 years to write the book, and I had to talk to all kinds of victims, and it's a very troubling book to read. But sometimes it's not that easy to coming across the truth is sometimes it can be very difficult to digest.
Now, if some of our listeners wanted to get your book, where could they get it?
Amazon.
You can get it on Amazon, or you can go to my website, which is www.franklinscandal.com, franklinscandal.com. And you can take a look at some interviews with me. You can listen to some interviews I've done. You can look at a documentary that was made about the Franklin scandal that was shelved by the Discovery Channel. There's a lot of information on my website, www.franklinscandal.com.
Well, we really urge our listeners to go to your website and get your book, and we really appreciate what you have to say. And thank you for doing that investigation.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
You're welcome. We hope to talk to you again.
Hope to see I hope to see the magazine come out here soon.
I do, too.
Your article, yeah. Well, Nick, thanks so much, and have a pleasant evening.
You too, Leo. Thank you.
All right.
Good night. Bye. That was Nick Bryant, and he was the author of the Franklin scandal. And hang on 1 second here. Okay.
We have.
Yeah.
Step into the ring with Woody.
Thank you, Lila. How's the sound on this, okay?
Oh, it's fine. You come across very clear.
Great. I have a new phone. I just wanted to make sure the phone line was fine. Okay. Good evening, sports fans. Watch your heads on the ropes as you step into the return of In the Ring with Woody. Tonight's topics, safety on ice, should I stay or should I go? Little Clash reference there. My Stone Cold Locks. A little talk on Sandusky. And, of course, some baseball. All right, let's get down to it. The NHL's most recognizable face and its leading scorer are both out after hits to the head. Pittsburgh Penguins star Sidney Crosby said Monday that he had concussion-like symptoms and was out indefinitely. Philadelphia Flyers center Claude Giroux, meanwhile, didn't accompany the team on his trip to play the Washington Capitals. He padded his league-leading point total to 39 with 2 assists Saturday, but had to leave the game after his own teammate, Wayne Simmonds, accidentally kneed him in the head. Flyers general manager Paul Holmgren said Giroux was feeling better, but would have to see the doctor again today. I get the feeling, I think if it was up to Giroux, he'd play tomorrow, Flyers forward. Yamir Yager said, the doctors have to make sure you don't want anything like that. Like what happened to Crosby, the aforementioned Crosby, you have to be very careful. Speaking of Crosby, now Crosby had already missed 2 games after not feeling right following a December 5th game against the Boston Bruins. He also had symptoms when he did, like, you know, light exercise. But Crosby is better off this time around than he was with a January concussion that kept him out until the lineup until this year, November 21st. He said he passed his most recent, what they call the impact test, concussion that kept on, which he took on Wednesday. I don't think frustrating that he even describes it. He told reporters in Pittsburgh, it's not fun, but I look at my impact test, and I look at a lot of that stuff, and I'm way better off than I was dealing with this, you know, some 10 months ago. You'll have to follow concussion protocol and a symptom-free at all stages of his recovery. As a result, there's no timetable for his return. It's kind of the whole routine again, but hopefully not that long, he said. That's something, you know, when I wasn't doing something for 6-7 months, that process was a little longer. Hopefully it's not the case here. If you notice, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of stuff in pro sports going on, you know, dudes are very concerned about headshots and stuff and concussions. You know, and that's why you see a lot of, you know, athletes from, let's say, the 80s, probably the 70s, you know, having, you know, brain aneurysms, so on and so forth later on in life. You know, you see a lot of these things. You know, you remember a lot of guys used to not even play with helmets when they played hockey and stuff, and, you know, a lot of dangerous stuff going on, you know, and you see the NFL also cracking down on, you know, helmet-to-helmet hits. It's all about head injuries and stuff. You know, you see a lot of pro sports are very, you know, very proactive now when it comes to protecting, you know, athletes, especially star athletes, guys such as Sidney Crosby. The NHL doesn't have a lot of stars, and, you know, the ones that you do have, you want to keep on the ice as often as possible. Moving on a little bit, a lot of trades going on. Now, I was wrong when I said the NBA wouldn't come back. I was dead sure they wouldn't come back, but as we all know, they have come back. And there's been a lot of trade talks and stuff going on. And the anticipation that point guard Chris Paul will be headed to Los Angeles at the end turned out to be a false alarm. For the second time in less than a week, the league-owned New Orleans Hornets failed to get a deal done for Paul that satisfied the NBA. Paul, in the final year of his contract, has told the Hornets he won't sign an extension to stay. Now, you remember, the NBA itself, you know, right now is running the Hornets. So they can't, on any level, look like they're giving, you know, a big player like that away to any team playing favoritism to a team. They have to, you know, make sure that they get a, you know, a good deal. It seems like they really want to get their pound of flesh. This guy's been trying, you know, they've been trying to trade this guy for, you know, for a couple, last couple weeks now. A person with knowledge of the deal who requested anonymity because there was no official announcement confirmed the Clippers offered to send the Hornets 7-foot center Chris Kanan, point guard Eric Bledsoe, forward Al-Farouq Aminu, and their unprotected 2012 draft pick via the Minnesota Timberwolves. Now, although the Hornets GM Del Demps wants to make the deal, the league said no unless Clippers shooting guard Eric Gordon, 22.3 points a game, was included too. Man, that really sounds like a pound of flesh. Also, he said he wouldn't part with Gordon and the draft pick. I certainly don't blame him. The NBA on Friday, citing basketball reasons, blocked a trade among the Hornets, Los Angeles Lakers, and the Houston Rockets that would have sent Paul to the Lakers. You know, as everybody knows, the Lakers don't lose stars. They acquire stars. The offer from the Clippers appeared to address at least some of those concerns. The Clippers made the winning waiver wire bid for guard Chauncey Billups, let go by the New York Knicks last week. Lakers Mitch Kupchak said Lamar Odom asked for a trade after being linked to the Paul deal, which is how he ended up with the Dallas Mavericks. Very nice. As you all know, Lamar Odom is married to one of the Kardashian sisters, so who gives a crap? Orlando Magic center Dwight Howard suggested he was willing to remain with the team if more talent was acquired. He's been holding them hostage. He's acting like he wants to go. Now he wants to stay. Should I stay or should I go? I just want to make sure we do have the right things here so we can win a championship, Howard said at the media Monday. If you're willing to change, you're willing to do what it takes to win, then you've got me. He later told NBA TV, there's no other place I'd rather be. Hopefully things will happen here the way they need to. Magic CEO Alex Martins, who took over for a longtime club exec Bob Vander Weed last week, has been active in discussions with Howard and said keeping him was a top goal. Yeah, well, we'll just have to see how that works out. All right. Moving on to my Stone Cold Locks. All right. Here we go, folks. You got the Detroit Lions going out to Oakland. Now, Oakland just got smoked by Green Bay this weekend, and they're heading home. They have nice warm weather. Lions aren't all that fantastic, you know, off the turf. Again, the Raiders are home. They're playing in the black hole. Raiders been up and down a little bit. They need this game. Detroit also needs this game, but I like Oakland because they're at home, and they're due just to smash somebody. And I think the Lions are going to be on the receiving end. Okay. Now, we have the San Diego Chargers playing at home against the Baltimore Ravens. The Chargers are at home, and they're getting points. Usually, as a rule, a home team getting points, usually you want to take the home team, you know, unless it's, you know, if it's a close game. But they're playing the Baltimore Ravens, and I like the Ravens, and I think they're going to probably shut the Chargers down. Spread is only 2. We'll probably get down to 1. I would definitely take the Ravens in this game. Monday Night Football, the line has not come out yet. It's the Niners against the Steelers. I don't care what the line is going to be. It'll probably be definitely under six. You know, maybe it'll be three. Probably be three, three and a half, something like that. I would take the Niners. Steelers are banged up. They may not play Ben Roethlisberger. As you know, Harrison is been suspended from this game, the big defensive guy. He's been suspended due to another helmet-to-helmet deal. They suspended him and fined him. Harrison's a little bit of a psycho. Dude, I'm all about hard-hitting, but cheap shots are kind of not that cool. And football has changed. It's not like back in the day. So you gotta change with the game. You can still lay a good stick on a dude, but, you know, we're not trying to end careers here. I mean, you can still make the highlight film, you know, put your head in somebody's chest. You don't got to put it in his helmet. So, I don't know, that's just kind of my thought on that. And I used to play defense, so, I mean, I love hitting offensive guys and catching them when they're not ready and all that other jazz. But, you know, within the rules of the game, would be a little bit better. All right. Speaking of rules of the game, how about rules of life? We got this guy, Jerry Sandusky, as we all know, the big child molester, allegedly. They made a ruling in court, which is kind of interesting. Credentialed news reporters will be allowed to email, text, and tweet updates from the preliminary hearing, which took place today, for former Penn State defensive coordinator Jerry Sandusky, a Pennsylvania judge, had ruled on Monday. To keep up with coverage, you know, all you got to do is get on some of these guys' Twitter accounts. Monday's ruling came in response to a motion filed by a law firm representing multiple national media organizations. Attorneys requested that Center County Court Senior Judge M. Cleland overturn a ruling that barred electronic communication from the courtroom. He said Monday, permitting tweeting will enhance the news-gathering capabilities of reporters, which is in the public's interest. Cleland said he expected the preliminary hearing to last one day. Sandusky, 67, is charged with more than 50 counts of child sex abuse involving 10 boys. God. He has acknowledged showering with boys, but it said he didn't molest them. Oh, man, that's classic. Today's prosecutors must show that there's enough evidence to bring Sandusky to trial, which, you know, I'm sure there is. A key witness is Mike McCreary, a current Penn State assistant coach, who, according to a grand jury, reportedly witnessed Sandusky rape a young boy in the shower in 2002. Recent media reports of McQuarrie's account of the incident have conflicted with the grand jury report. Patriot News of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, reportedly that McQuarrie told Jonathan Jovanov, a family friend, that he heard sex sounds but not see sexual acts immediately after the 2002 incident. Jovanov also testified in front of the grand jury. Not exactly sure what sex sounds with a man and a 10-year-old boy sounds like. It would probably be a lot of crying and screaming. It's absolutely disgusting. This guy should be hung from the first available tree. I'm sure the justice system will really take care of him. One can only hope that, you know, he gets what he has coming to him. The guy what is being reported as true is truly an animal and should be dealt with as an animal. Anyway, just a quick little comment on my Chicago Bears. Man, they're kind of going down in flames. We've lost our quarterback, Jay Cutler, possibly for the rest of the season, and our running back, Matt Forte. They haven't won a game since Cutler went down, and they lost a tough one this weekend to Jesus Christ himself, Tim Tebow, as everybody likes to call him. Tebow's been really, really amazing with the Broncos. He's 8-1 as a starter. It's kind of unbelievable. Everyone, all the supposed people in the know have picked against him, say he doesn't know what he's doing, blah, blah, blah. But somehow he's winning, and God, everybody likes a winner. So, but he's most known for doing, you know, he does the sign of the cross, you know, all sort of jazz. He's a big religious guy, so a lot of people are not kind of down with that. And a lot of people make comments on it. I'm not a big fan of it myself either, but whatever. Whatever floats your boat, I guess. Okay, a little bit of baseball stuff. As you all know, Albert Pujols moved from the St. Louis Cardinals all the way out to the Los Angeles Angels. It's a big move for them, and the Angels also picked up sought-after pitcher C.J. Wilson. It was, you know, talking to the Yankees, they're possibly thinking about going after Wilson, but his price tag was too high, and his performance in the playoffs was less than stellar. Frankly, I'm quite glad the Yankees didn't make a move on him at all. also alleged that, you know, many major leisure clubs have until they have until 5 p.m. tomorrow to submit posting bid for Japanese right-hander Yu Darvish. All signs point to the Yankees probably sitting this one out, too. Although Yankee scouts are high in the 25-year-old's ability, the total cost of Yu Darvish is considered too high even for the Yanks, according to MLB.
All right.
Keep going,
We're all right there?
Yep, you're all right. Go ahead.
Right, thank you. How professional. According to MLB sources, it could take close to $30 million to win the posting process. That's just the posting process. The same source indicated Darvish will then want a 5-year deal in the area of $75 million. That's more than $100 million for a pitcher who's done very well facing hitters in Japan. But those hitters are not anywhere near, you know, the major league caliber here over here. The Yankees were burned once already by Keiagawa, who cost them $46 million, a 26 posting fee, and then $20 million for 5 years. And he pitched in 16 big league games, none since 2008. And boy, he's horrible to watch. By all accounts, Darvish is a lot better than Keiagawa. However, the price tag will be considerably higher. Said to be in the running with the Rangers and the Nationals. But, you know, but at what price? Of course, the Yankees could make a low bid with the idea that if they win, they would hold the exclusive rights, you know, to negotiate with Darvish. Nevertheless, if he wants $75 million for 5 years and the posting fee is $15 million, that's more money than established big league starter C.J. Wilson. As I said, he got $77.5 million and Mark Burley $58 million last week. Yankees did tender a 1-year deal to catcher Russell Martin. Martin can hear footsteps behind him because, as you know, the Yankees have a guy in the waiting who, you know, if he can catch, that would be great, Jesus Martero. But right now people are looking at him more as like a designated hitter, and his catching skills just aren't ready for the major leagues yet. But, hey, you never know. Jorge Posada never had the greatest catching ability, but they put him behind the plate, and, you know, although, you know, the last couple of years he hasn't been fantastic. He sure was in the beginning of his career. You know, he's a borderline Hall of Famer. So, you know, I would be surprised if the Yankees, you know, offer him a multi-year deal next year. But, hey, it's, you know, it's a, you know, very big possibility. So we'll just have to wait and see. But that's it for this week. Shout out to all my witheads out there, Ron, Mark, Leo, Dino, Troy, Greg, and AFS. They were at the Northeast Athletic Club, especially my partner, Money Mike. That's it for this week. Get your Christmas shopping done. Peace out.
Our guest, who was the author of the Franklin scandal.
Yeah. Nick Bryant.
Nick Bryant.
You check his work out on his website, The Franklin Scandal, as well as go to Amazon.com and check out his book.
Yeah. Very timely. Now, you know, when you think back on it, he wrote that book, and now he's kind of in demand a little bit to talk about that scandal. And maybe how some of the patterns are the same with this new Jerry Sandusky scandal.
Well, we interviewed Nick
a few years back.
I think it was about a year ago. Back in 2010 when his book first came out.
Mm-hmm.
And on the Franklin scandal, and it was quite something then. And he said it was unbelievable how nobody would touch his book. All right, you know, he sent it to the media.
People just didn't want to deal with that issue.
And he said it was really difficult. It was a tough book to read because it was really
horrific.
It crossed a lot of taboos, and you went, holy cow. You know
when
and,
you think of
right
Boys Town, you think that's
well,
the place
well,
that protects
not
children.
That. It was the White House.
And
I mean,
the White
know,
House,
and,
yeah.
And old man Bush. I mean, you know, the corrupt, the miserable, former director of the CIA, all right, and
others,
you know, and just miserable human being, right? And, you know, you didn't know his 1,000 points of light were 1,000 little boys, you know, that he could play with. So it was like, you know, it was quite a nasty thing. But I highly suggest you read the book, The Franklin Scandal, if you can.
Stomach it.
Well,
it's a hard read.
It's a very good book. This one here, I want to end the show with this. We always try to bring up news about aspartame and artificial sweeteners when we can, because it's so pervasive. You can't buy anything today practically without it in some of this crap aspartame in it. And artificial sweetener disease is a new breed of sickness. Artificial sweetener disease, or ASD, is sweeping across America, affecting tens of thousands of consumers, and Western medicine calls it anything but what it really is, so that doctors can prescribe expensive pharmaceuticals and set up checkup appointments for the following week. Call it reoccurring headaches, unbearable migraines, depression, anxiety, muscle pain, arthritis flare-ups, buzzing or ringing in the ears, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, irritable bowel syndrome, Crohn's disease, inflammation, even acid reflux. But don't call it ASD, or the patient may stop consuming synthetic sweeteners and then not schedule more doctor visits. The symptoms of ASD, artificial sweetener disease, can change overnight depending on how much chemical sweetener you consume and which ones. Some combinations are especially toxic. Consumers can go from a migraine headache to vomiting, or from vision problems to an upset stomach. And many people experience central nervous system disorders, cramping, nervous twitches, and abnormal reflexes.
It all started when Ronald Reagan took office in 1980. He immediately fired the head of the FDA under advisement from Donald Rumsfeld, CEO of Cereal Pharmaceutical at the time, and hired Dr. Arthur Hall Hayes, Jr., who auspiciously approved aspartame. It was the decade of the diet craze, and Rumsfeld and his constituents made a fortune off the artificial sweetener, which had been banned for decades due to laboratory testing proving it was carcinogenic. The same FDA-tainted approval process gave way to sucralose in 1991 and sorbitol in 2003.
Gulf War syndrome, mainly ASD.
It is not a coincidence that the wave of fibromyalgia cases hit the American troops during the Gulf War. Studies revealed that drinking diet sodas in the 120-degree heat led to serious health repercussions. It was cleverly chalked up under the umbrella term Gulf War syndrome. But the same problems are occurring for troops in Iraq and Afghanistan now. It is also no coincidence that 4 out of 5 fibromyalgia cases affect women, who are more likely to eat diet food and consume diet drinks than men. Nearly all chewing gum and breath mints are loaded with artificial sweeteners. The popular saying that there's not enough artificial sweetener in specific product to cause health concerns is a lie, especially now that in 2011, there are synthetic sweeteners in over 25% of all food, drink, gum, and candy available. This cumulative effect has created ASD, and thanks to little or no regulation of chemical agents in food, it's not going away anytime soon. There is no prescription drug, and there never will be one that cures the problem that artificial sweeteners create. In fact, over 70% of reported cases of fibromyalgia, chronic depression, IBS and acid reflux are consumed by chemical agents which have been approved by the FDA for consumption. Cancer may be the distant long-term result of consuming chemicals, but ASD is the short-term consequence, and it's quite serious. If you look to prescription drugs to cure these chronic ailments, you will experience even more side effects from the prescription medicine and maybe worse ones than you already have. The good news is the cure for artificial sweetness disease is absolutely free, and it involves no doctor, no health insurance copays, and has zero side effects. Here is the secret cure for ASD. Throw away your sugar-free gum and candy, then trash all foods and drinks that you have that are labeled light and zero. Read the labels on everything so you can filter out all artificial sweeteners from your products, including aspartame, sucralose, sorbitol, acesulfame K, aspartic acid, and saccharin. As an alternative to poisoning yourself, try xylitol or stevia in order to cut calories, or simply eat more organic vegetables. If problems persist, take a list of everything you ate this week to your naturopath and nutritionist to analyze. Remember, if you're getting sick from moldy bread, don't look for a prescription drug to cure you. Just stop eating moldy bread.
There you go. So that's another thing with aspartame, which is artificial sweetener disease. Imagine that. They've even connected Gall syndrome to that.
I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, that's amazing. Oh, my God. Did you know that microwave popcorn, which most people like, gives off damaging lung toxic lung damaging gas when cooked?
Huh.
Yeah. Natural news. You might be assured to learn that the buttery flavor in microwave popcorn typically comes from a chemical actually found in butter, but you shouldn't be. This chemical called diacetyl is so toxic that it commonly destroys the lungs of workers in microwave popcorn factories, afflicting them with a crippling and irreversible disease known as bronchiolitis obliterans.
Bronchiolitis obliterans is so rare outside of this context that has become commonly known as popcorn lung after the primary cause of the disease. Regulators and health professionals have known of this risk for decades, but always assumed it would only affect people breathing in high concentrations in factory settings. Then in 2007, a man who regularly ate 2 bags of popcorn every day was diagnosed with popcorn lung, indicating that diacetyl enters the air and lungs when microwave popcorn is cooked. Anxious to reassure consumers, most microwave popcorn companies phased out diacetyl, only to replace it with chemicals that have the same effect.
Oh, God.
Jeez. Today you can still find diacetyl in many flavored snack foods and even in some so-called natural foods. Make sure you read the ingredients of any food you intend to consume and make sure it contains no diacetyl and no yeast extract for that matter either.
That diacetyl is spelled D-I-A-C-E-T-Y-L, and no yeast extract. Oh.
I don't know why.
I don't know either. Well, anyway.
There's an awful lot we don't know.
Pretty scary.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Okay.
This is interesting, too. We'll end with this one because if you're federal agents raid Mormon food storage facility, demand a list of customers storing emergency food.
This story has been updated with new developments that include News Channel 5 confirming door-to-door questioning of Tennessee citizens about their stored food, as well as the cannery in question. Here now reversing their original account and saying it never happened. Here is the original story as posted. As was the plan all along, the so-called war on terror has officially developed into the war on the American people. This was clearly illustrated by the recent traitorous passage of the egregious National Defense Authorization Act by the U.S. Congress. But in order to fully implement the ultimate goal of total control and tyranny, the federal government is now actively collecting the names of individuals that are preparing for the future by buying and storing emergency food supplies. Oath Keepers, an association of active servicemen devoted to upholding their oath of guarding the Republic and protecting individual liberty, has reported that federal agents recently paid a visit to a Latter-day Saints food storage cannery in Tennessee. Though they had no reason to be there, these agents allegedly interrogated the facility's manager and demanded to see a list of customers that had purchased and were storing food there. Oathkeepers Tennessee chapter president Randall Cartwell confirmed the incident, according to reports, as he is in close contact with a fellow veteran who happens to store his own food in the facility in question.
30 seconds. We've got just 30 seconds remaining to this program, so if you'd like to call in, do it now. We'll finish this article.
Or you can catch it on the archive.
Yeah. So I want to thank everybody who joined us tonight, and we'll just continue this article and finish the program. I don't know.
So
we
talked about Nordic Defoleting, let's see, right here. So they had no reason to be there. The agents allegedly interrogated the facility's manager and demanded to see a list of customers. Okay, we were there. Okay. Oathkeeper Tennessee Chapter President Rand Cartwell confirmed the incident, according to reports, as he is in close contact with a fellow veteran who happens to store his own food at the facility in question. According to the man's account, agents entered the facility and began demanding payment records and personal information for everyone connected with the operation. The manager informed the agents that the facility kept no such records and all transactions were conducted on a cash-and-carry basis. Cardwell is quoted as saying, concerning the incident, the agents pressed for any record of personal checks, credit card transactions. But the manager could provide no such record. The agents appeared to become very agitated after several minutes of questioning and finally left with no information. This unprovoked act of intimidation is highly concerning, but it is also somewhat contradictory. On the one hand, the federal government has been instilling fear in the American public for years and has even made announcements urging people to be prepared. But on the other hand, the same government is now pursuing those who are heeding these precautions as if they are terrorists. Oathkeepers suggest the government might be trying to gather intelligence on food-storing Americans in order to later come and confiscate the food, or worse. After all, freedom-loving patriots who are preparing for social upheaval are a threat to the power structure that seeks to tighten the noose of tyranny around the neck of society.
I'll tell you something. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, Oathkeepers, I hope they do keep their oaths. And I'd be one to fight to the finish with someone stealing my food or coming in and breaking into my house. I don't care if they're wearing a uniform or they're wearing, they're wearing nothing. All right? They're both going to be treated the same way. So on that note, I thank you for listening, everybody.
And thanks, folks. I hope you have a good evening, good night,
yeah.
And we'll talk to you tomorrow.
Yeah. We'll be right back.